Cruel and Barbarous Treatment by Mary McCarthy. She could not bear to hurt her husband. She impressed this on the young man, on her confidants, and finally on her husband himself. The thought of telling him actually made her heart turn over in a sudden and sickening way, she said. This was true, and yet she knew that being a potential divorcee was deeply pleasurable in somewhat the same way that being an engaged girl had been. In both cases, there was at first a subterranean courtship, whose significance it was necessary to conceal from outside observers. The concealment of the original premarital courtship had, however, been a mere superstitious gesture, briefly sustained. It had also been, on the whole, a private secretness, not a partnership of silence. One put one's family and one's friends off the track because one was still afraid that the affair might not come out right, might not lead in a clean, direct line to the altar. To confess one's aspirations might be, in the end, to publicise one's failure. Once a solid understanding had been reached, there followed a short intermission of ritual bashfulness, in which both parties awkwardly participated, and then came the announcement. But with the extramarital courtship, the deception was prolonged where it had been ephemeral, necessary where it had been frivolous, conspiratorial where it had been lonely. It was, in short, serious where it had been dilettantish. That it was accompanied by feelings of guilt, by sharp and genuine revulsions, only complicated and deepened its delights by abrading the sensibilities and by imposing a sense of outlawry and consequent mutual dependence upon the lovers. But what this interlude of deception gave her, above all she recognised, was an opportunity, unparalleled in her experience, for exercising feelings of superiority over others. For her husband, she had, she believed, only sympathy and compunction. She got no fun, she told the young man, out of putting horns on her darling's head. And never for a moment, she said, did he appear to her as the comic figure of the cuckolded husband that once saw on the stage. The young man assured her that his own sentiments were equally delicate, that for the wronged man he felt the most profound respect, tinged with consideration. It was as if by the mere act of betraying her husband she had adequately bested him. It was supererogatory for her to gloat, and if she gloated at all, it was over her fine restraint in not gloating, over the integrity of her moral sense, which allowed her to preserve, even while engaged in sinfulness, the acute realization of sin and shame. Her overt superiority, feelings she reserved for her friends. Lunches and teas, which had been time killers, matters of routine, now became perilous and dramatic adventures. The young man's name was a bright, highly explosive ball which she bounced casually back and forth in these feminine tete-a-tetes. She would discuss him in the status of friend of the family, speculate on what girls he might have, attack him or defend him, anatomize him, keep her eyes clear and impersonal, her voice empty of special emphasis, her manner humorously detached. While all the time. 3 times a week, or oftener, at lunch or tea, she would let herself tremble thus on the exquisite edge of self-betrayal, involving her companions in a momentous game whose rules and whose risks she only herself she knew. For that, the public appearances were even more satisfactory. To meet at a friend's house by design and to register surprise, to strike just the right note of young matronly affection at cocktail parties, to treat him formally as my escort at the theatre during intermissions. These were triumphs of stage management. More difficult of execution, more nerve-wracking than the lunches and teas, because two actors were involved. His over-ardent glance must be hastily deflected. His too self-conscious reading of his lines must be entered in the debit side of her ledger of love, in anticipation of an indulgent accounting in private. The imperfections of his performance were indeed pleasing to her. Not, she thought, because his impetuosities, his gaucheries, demonstrated the sincerity of his passion for her, nor because they proved him a new hand at this game of intrigue, but rather because the high finish of her own acting showed off well in comparison. "I should have gone on the stage," she could tell him gaily, "or been a diplomat's wife or an international spy," while he would admiringly agree. Actually, she doubted whether she could have ever been an actress, acknowledging that she found it more amusing and more gratifying to play herself than to interpret any character conceived by a dramatist. In these private theatricals, it was her own many-faced nature that she put on exhibit, and the audience, in this case unfortunately limited to two, could applaud both her skill of projection and her intrinsic variety. Furthermore, this was a play in which the donné was real, and the penalty for a missed cue or an inopportune entrance was, at first anyway, unthinkable. She loved him, she knew, for being a bad actor, for his docility in accepting her tender, mock-impatient instruction. Those superiority feelings were fattening, not only on the gullibility of her friends, but also on the comic flaws of her lover's character, and on the vulnerability of her lover's position. In this particular hive, she was undoubtedly Queen Bee. The public appearances were not exclusively duets. They sometimes took the form of a trio. On these occasions, the studied and benevolent carefulness which she always showed for her husband's feelings served a double purpose. She would affect a conspicuous domesticity, an affectionate conjugal demonstrativeness, would sprinkle her conversation with darlings, and punctuate it with pats and squeezes till her husband would visibly expand and her lover plainly and painfully shrink. For the young man, no retaliation was possible. These endearments of hers were sanctioned by law, usage, and habit. They belonged to her role of wife, and could not be condemned or paralleled by a young man who was himself unmarried. They were clear provocations, but they could not be called so, and the young man preferred not to speak of them. But she knew. Though she was aware of the sadistic intention of these displays, she was not ashamed of them, as she was sometimes twistingly ashamed of the hurt she was preparing to inflict on her husband. Partly, she felt that they were punishments which the young man richly deserved for the wrong he was doing her husband, and that she herself, in contriving them, was acting, quite fittingly, both as judge and as accused. Partly, too, she believed herself justified in playing the fond wife, whatever the damage to her lover's ego, because, in a sense, she actually was a fond wife. She did have these feelings, she insisted, whether she was exploiting them or not. Eventually, however, her reluctance to wound her husband and her solicitude for his pride were overcome by an inner conviction that her love affair must move on to its next preordained stage. The possibilities of the subterranean courtship had been exhausted. It was time for the announcement. She and the young man began to tell each other in a rather breathless and literary style that the situation was impossible and things couldn't go on this way any longer. The ostensible meaning of these flurried laments was that, under present conditions, they were not seeing enough of each other. That their hours together were too short and their periods of separation too dismal, and that the whole business of deception had become morally distasteful to them. Perhaps the young man really believed these things. She did not. For the first time, she saw that the virtue of marriage as an institution lay in its public character. Private cohabitation, long continued, was, she concluded, a bore. Whatever the cosiness of isolation, the warm delights of having a secret, a love affair finally reached the point where it needed the glare of its publicity to revive the interest of its protagonists. Hence, she thought, the engagement parties, the showers, the big church weddings, the presents, the receptions. These were simply socially approved devices by which the lovers got themselves talked about. The gossip value of a divorce and remarriage was obviously far greater than the gossip value of a mere engagement. And she was now ready, indeed hungry, to hear what people would say. The lunches, the teas, the public appearances were getting a little flat. It was not in the end enough to be a woman with a secret, if one's friends appeared to be a woman without a secret. The bliss of having a secret required, in short, the consummation of telling it, and she looked forward to the "my dear, I had no ideas," the "I thought you and Bill were so happy together's," the "how did you keep it so in the dark?" with which her intimates would greet her announcement. The audience of two no longer sufficed her. She required a larger stage. She tried it first, a little nervously, on two or three of her closest friends, swearing them to secrecy. "Bill must hear it first from me," she declared. "It would be too terrible for his pride if he found out afterward that the whole town knew it before he did, so you mustn't tell, even later on, that I told you about this today. I felt I had to talk to someone." After these lunches, she would hurry to a phone booth to give the young man the gist of the conversation, just as a reporter, set to cover a fire, telephones into the city desk. She certainly was surprised, she could always say with a little gush of triumph. "But she thinks it's fine." But did they, actually? She could not be sure. Was it possible that she sensed in these luncheon companions, her dearest friends, a certain reserve, a certain unexpressed judgment? It was a pity, she reflected, that she was so sensitive to public opinion. "I couldn't really love a man," she murmured to herself once, "if everybody didn't think he was wonderful." Everyone seemed to like the young man, of course. But still, she was getting panicky, she thought. Surely it was only common sense that nobody is admired by everybody. And even if a man were universally despised, would there not be a kind of defiant nobility in loving him in the teeth of the whole world? There would, certainly, but it was a type of heroism that she would scarcely be called upon to practice, for the young man was popular. He was invited everywhere. He danced well. His manners were ingratiating. He kept up intellectually. But was he not perhaps too amiable, too accommodating? Was it for this that her friends seemed silently to criticise him? At this time, a touch of acridity entered into her relations with the young man. Her indulgent scoldings had an edge to them now, and it grew increasingly difficult for her to keep her make-believe impatience from becoming real. She would look for dark spots in his character and drill away at them as relentlessly as a dentist at a cavity. A compulsive didacticism possessed her. No truism of his, no cliché, no ineffectual joke could pass the rigidity of her censorship. And, hard as she tried to maintain the character of charming schoolmistress, the young man, she saw, was taking alarm. She suspected that, frightened and puzzled, he contemplated flight. She found herself watching him with scientific interest, speculating as to what course he would take, and she was relieved but faintly disappointed when it became clear that he ascribed her sharpness to the tension of the situation and had decided to stick it out. The moment had come for her to tell her husband. By this single cathartic act, she would, she believed, rid herself of the doubts and anxieties that beset her. If her husband were to impugn the young man's character, she could answer his accusations and at the same time discount them as arising from jealousy. From her husband, at least, she might expect the favour of an open attack to which she could respond with the prepared defence that she carried, unspoken, about with her. Further, she had an intense childlike curiosity as to how her husband would take it, a curiosity which she disguised, for decency's sake, as justifiable apprehension. The confidences already imparted to her friends seemed like pale dress rehearsals of the supreme confidence she was about to make. Perhaps it was toward this moment that the whole affair had been tending, for this moment that the whole affair had been designed. This would be the ultimate testing of her husband's love, its final, rounded, quintessential expression. Never, she thought, when you live with a man, do you feel the full force of his love. It is gradually rationed out to you in an impure state, compounded with all the other elements of daily existence, so that you are hardly sensible of receiving it. There is no single point at which it is concentrated. It spreads out into the past and the future until it appears as a nearly imperceptible film over the surface of your life. Only face to face with its own annihilation could it show itself wholly, and, once shown, drop into the category of completed experiences. That was good. She was not disappointed. She told him at breakfast in a fashionable restaurant because, she said, he would be better able to control his feelings in public. When he called at once for the check, she had a spasm of alarm lest in an access of brutality or grief he leave her there alone, conspicuous. Lost my place. Shit. And, as it were, unfulfilled. Let's do that again. When he called at once for the check, she had a spasm of alarm, lest in an access of brutality or grief he leave her there alone, conspicuous, and, as it were, unfulfilled. But they walked out of the restaurant together and through the streets, hand in hand, tears streaming, unchecked, she whispered to herself down their faces. Later they were in the park, by an artificial lake, watching the ducks swim. The sun was very bright and she felt a kind of superb pathos in the careful and irrelevant attention they gave to the pastoral scene. This was, she knew, the most profound, the most subtle, the most idyllic experience of her life. All the strings of her nature were, at last, vibrant. She was both doer and sufferer. She inflicted pain and participated in it. And she was, at the same time, physician. For she was the weapon that dealt the wound. She was also the balm that could assuage it. Only she knew and could know the hurt that engrossed him, and it was to her that he turned for the sympathy she had ready for him. Finally, though she offered him his discharge slip with one hand, with the other she beckoned him to approach. She was wooing him all over again, but wooing him to a deeper attachment than he had previously experienced, to an unconditional surrender. She was demanding his total understanding of her, his compassion and his forgiveness. When at last he answered her, he repeated and agonized, "I love yous," by grasping her hand more tightly and saying gently, "I know." She saw that she had won him over. She had drawn him into a truly mystical union. The marriage was complete. Afterwards, everything was more prosaic. The young man had to be telephoned and summoned to a conference en trois, a conference, she said, of civilized, intelligent people. The young man was a little awkward, even dropped a tear or two, which embarrassed everyone else. But what, after all, she thought, could you expect? He was in a difficult position. His was a thankless part. With her husband behaving so well, indeed so gallantly, the young man could not fail to look a trifle inadequate. The young man would have preferred it, of course, if her husband had made a scene, had bullied or threatened her, so that he himself might have acted the chivalrous protector. She, however, did not hold her husband's heroic courtesy against him. In some way, it reflected credit on herself. The young man apparently was expecting to carry her off, but this she would not allow. It would be too heartless, she whispered when they were alone for a moment. We must all go somewhere together. So the three went out for a drink, and she watched with a sort of desperation her husband's growing abstraction, the more and more perfunctory attention he accorded the conversation she was so bravely sustaining. He is bored, she thought. He's going to leave. The prospect of being left alone with a young man seemed suddenly unendurable. If a husband were to go now, he would take with him the third dimension that she had given the affair, and abandoned her to a flat and vulgar love scene. Terrified, she wondered whether she had not already prolonged the drama beyond its natural limits, whether the confession in the restaurant and the absolution in the park had not rounded off the artistic whole, whether the sequel of divorce and remarriage would not, in fact, constitute an anticlimax. Already she sensed that behind her husband's good manners, an ironical attitude toward herself had sprung up. Was it possible that he had believed that they would return from the park and all would continue as before? It was conceivable that her protestations of love had been misleading, and that his enormous tenderness toward her had been based not on the idea that he was giving her up, but rather on the idea that he was taking her back with no questions asked. If that were the case, the telephone call, the conference, and the excursion had, in his eyes, been a monstrous gaffe, a breach of sensibility and good taste, for which he would never forgive her. She blushed violently. Looking at him again, she thought he was watching her with an expression which declared, I have found you out. Now I know what you are like. For the first time, she felt him utterly alienated. When he left them, she experienced the letdown she had feared, but also a kind of relief. She told herself that it was as well that he had cut himself off from her. It made her decision simpler. There was now nothing for her to do but to push the love affair to its conclusion, whatever that might be. And this was probably what she most deeply desired. Had the poignant intimacy of the park persisted, she might have been tempted to drop the adventure she had begun and return to her routine. But that was, looked at coldly, unthinkable. For if the park would seem a little flat after the scene... For if the adventure would seem a little flat after the scene in the park, the resumption of her marriage would seem even flatter. If the drama of the triangle had been amputated by her confession, the curtain had been brought down with a smack on the drama of wedlock. And, as it turned out, the drama of the triangle was not quite ended by the superficial rupture of her marriage. Though she had left her husband's apartment and been offered shelter by a confidant, it was still necessary for her to see him every day. There were clothes to be packed and possessions to be divided, love letters to be reread and mementos to be wept over in common. There were occasional passionate, unconsummated embraces. There were endearments and promises. And though her husband's irony remained, it was frequently vulnerable. It was not, as she had first thought, an armour against her, but merely a sword out of Tristan and Isolde, which lay permanently between them and enforced discretion. They met often also at the houses of friends, for, as she said, "What can I do? I know it's not tactful, but we know all the same people. You can't expect me to give up my friends." These public appearances were heightened in interest by the fact that these audiences, unlike the earlier ones, had, as it were, purchased librettos and were in full possession of the intricacies of the plot. She preferred, she decided, the evening parties to the cocktail parties, for there she could dance alternatively with her lover and her husband to the accompaniment of subdued gasps on the part of the bystanders. This interlude was at the same time festive and heart-rending. Her only dull moments were the evenings she spent alone with the young man. Unfortunately, the post-announcement period was only too plainly an interlude, and its very nature demanded that it be followed by something else. She could not preserve her anomalous status indefinitely. It was not decent, and besides, people would be bored. From the point of view of one's friends, it was all very well to entertain a triangle as a novelty. To cope with it as a permanent problem was a different matter. Once they had all three gotten drunk, and there was a scene, and, though everyone talked about it afterward, her friends were, she thought, a little colder, a little more critical. People began to ask her when she was going to Reno. Furthermore, she noticed that her husband was getting a slight edge in popularity over the young man. It was natural, of course, that everyone should feel sorry for him and be especially nice. But yet... When she learned from her husband that he was receiving invitations from members of her own circle, invitations in which she and the young man were unaccountably not included, she went at once to the station and bought her ticket. Her goodbye to her husband, which she had privately allocated to her last hours in town, took place prematurely, 2 days before she was to leave. He was rushing off to what she inwardly felt was a gay weekend in the country. He had only a few minutes. He wished her a pleasant trip, and he would write, of course. His highball was drained while her glass stood half full. He sat forward nervously on his chair, and she knew herself to be acting the ancient mariner, but her dignity would not allow her to hurry. She hoped that he would miss his train for her, but he did not. He left her sitting in the bar, and that night the young man could not, as he put it, do a thing with her. There was nowhere, absolutely nowhere, she said passionately, that she wanted to go. Nobody she wanted to see, nothing she wanted to do. "You need a drink," he said, with the air of a diagnostician. "A drink," she answered bitterly. "I'm sick of the drinks we've been having. Gin, whiskey, rum, what else is there?" He took her into a bar and she cried. But he bought her a fancy mixed drink, something called a Ramos Gin Fizz. And she was a little appeased because she had never had one before. Then some friends came in, and they all had another drink together, and she felt better. "There," said the young man on the way home, "don't I know what's good for you? Don't I know how to handle you?" "Yes," she answered in her most humble and feminine tones, but she knew that they had suddenly dropped into a new pattern, that they were no longer the cynosure of a social group, but merely another young couple with an evening to pass. Another young couple looking desperately for entertainment, wondering whether to call on a married couple or drop in somewhere for a drink. This time, the young man's prescription had worked, but it was pure luck that they had chanced to meet someone they knew. A second or a third time, they would scan the faces of the other drinkers in vain, would order a second drink and surreptitiously watch the door, and finally go out alone with a quick, detectable air of being unwanted. When, a day and a half later, the young man came late to take her to the train, and they had to run down the platform to catch it, she found him all at once detestable. He would ride to 125th Street with her. he declared in a burst of gallantry. But she was angry all the way because she was afraid there would be trouble with the conductor. At 125th Street, he stood on the platform blowing kisses to her and shouting something that she could not hear through the glass. She made a gesture of repugnance, but seeing him flinch, seeing him weak and charming and incompetent, she brought back her hand reluctantly to her lips and blew a kiss back. The other passengers were watching, she was aware, and though their looks were doting and not derisive, she felt herself to be humiliated and somehow vulgarised. When the train began to move and the young man began to run down the platform after it, still blowing kisses and shouting alternately, she got up, turned sharply away from the window and walked back to the club car. There she sat down and ordered a whisky and soda. There were a number of men in the car who looked up in unison as she gave her order, but observing that they were all the middle-aged small businessmen who belonged as inevitably to the club car as the white-coated porter and the leather-bound Saturday Evening Post, she paid them no heed. She was now suddenly overcome by a sense of depression and loss that was unprecedented for being in no way dramatic or pleasurable. In the last half-hour she had seen clearly that she would never marry the young man, and she found herself looking into an insubstantial future, with no signpost to guide her. Almost all women, she thought, when they are girls, never believe they will get married. The terror of spinsterhood hangs over them from adolescence on. Even if they are popular, they think that no one really interesting will want them enough to marry them. Even if they get engaged, they are afraid that something will go wrong. Something will intervene. When they do get married, it seems to them a sort of miracle. And after they have been married for a time, though in retrospect the whole process looks perfectly natural and inevitable, they retain a certain unarticulated pride in the wonder they have performed. Finally, however, the terror of spinsterhood has been so thoroughly exorcised that they forgot ever having been haunted by it, and it is at this stage that they contemplate divorce. How could I have forgotten, she said to herself, and began to wonder what she would do. She could take an apartment by herself in the village. She would meet new people. She would entertain. But, she thought, if I have people in for cocktails, there will always come the moment when they have to leave, and I will be alone and have to pretend to have another engagement in order to save the embarrassment. But if I have them to dinner, it will be the same thing, but at least I will not have to pretend to have an engagement. I shall give dinners. Then, she said, there will be the cocktail parties, and if I go alone, I shall always stay a little too late, hoping that a young man or even a party of people will ask me to dinner. And if I fail, if no one asks me, I shall have the ignominy of walking out alone, trying to look as if I had somewhere to go. Then there will be the evenings at home with a good book, when there will be no reason at all for going to bed, and I shall perhaps sit up all night. And the mornings, when there will be no point in getting up, and I shall perhaps stay in bed till dinner time. There will be the dinners in tea-rooms with other unmarried women. Tea-rooms because women alone look conspicuous and forlorn in good restaurants. And then, she thought, I shall get older. She would never, she reflected angrily, have taken this step had she felt she was burning her bridges behind her. She would never have left one man unless she had had another to take his place. But the young man, she now saw, was merely a sort of mirage, which she had allowed herself to mistake for an oasis. If the man, she muttered, did not exist, the moment would create him. This was what had happened to her. She had made herself the victim of an imposture. But, she argued with an access of cheerfulness, if this were true, if out of the need of a second, a new husband, she had conjured up the figure of one, she had possibly been impelled by unconscious forces to behave more intelligently, than appearances would indicate. She was perhaps acting out in a sort of hypnotic trance, a ritual whose meanings had not yet been revealed to her, a ritual which required that, first of all, the husband be eliminated from the cast of characters. Conceivably, she was designed for the role of femme fatale, and for such a personage, considerations of safety, provisions against loneliness and old age, were not only philistine, but irrelevant. She might marry a second, a third, a fourth time, or she might never marry again. But in any case, for the thrifty bourgeois love insurance, with its daily payments of patience, forbearance, and resignation, she was no longer eligible. She would be, she told herself delightedly, a bad risk. She was, or soon would be, a young divorcée, and the term still carried glamour. Her divorce decree would be a passport conferring on her the status of citizenness of the world. She felt gratitude toward the young man for having unwittingly effected her transit into a new life. She looked about her at the other passengers. Later she would talk to them. They would ask, of course, where she was bound for. That was the regulation opening move of train conversations, but it was a delicate question what her reply should be. To say Reno straight out would be vulgar. It would smack of confidences too cheaply given. Yet to lie, to say San Francisco, for instance, would be to cheat herself, to minimise her importance, to mislead her interlocutor into believing her an ordinary traveller with a commonplace destination. There must be some middle course which would give information without appearing to do so, which would hint at a vie galante, yet indicate a barrier of impeccable reserve. It would probably be best, she decided, to say west at first, with an air of vagueness and hesitation. Then, when pressed, she might go so far as to say Nevada, but no further.